Chapter 11 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 11. It has been pointed out to me that to the present or rising generation of those who may read this book, the names of Frank Harris and Robert Ross convey little or nothing. Frank Harris had certainly, before he left England for good, about 3 or 4 years before the war, established a reputation as a considerable man of letters and a great talker. His name and reputation are perfectly familiar to most of the elder men of letters in London today, but outside this circle he is now unknown. His books are not read in England, and his name is almost forgotten. When I first met him, in 1894 or thereabouts, he occupied a commanding position in contemporary letters and journalism. He was editor of the Fortnightly Review, and had published a volume of short stories, called Elder Conklin, which was highly praised by competent critics. As editor of the Fortnightly Review, he had the discrimination to print, and pay highly for, Oscar Wilde's brilliant essays, The Decay of the Art of Lying, and The Critic as Artist. He married a wealthy lady, who had a house in Park Lane next to that occupied by George Wyndham and his wife, Lady Grosvenor. While Frank Harris remained with his first wife, he came into considerable prominence in the social and literary world as the giver of dinner parties, where the conversation was supposed to soar to unusual heights of brilliance. His origin was wrapped in mystery, and those who wish to examine his own account of his youth, parentage, and early adventures can, unfortunately, only do so by reading his latest book, My Life and Loves, which is a work of almost pure pornography. Copies coming into England by post are seized and destroyed by the postal authorities, and anyone found selling it would be liable to be sent to prison. During the short period already alluded to in this book, when I was on friendly terms with Harris again, after an interval of 15 years estrangement, when he was writing the new preface to The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, he sent me a copy of My Life and Loves to the hotel where I was staying in Nice. I read about 30 or 40 pages of it, and then wrapped it up in paper and sent it back to Harris by special messenger, with a note in which I told him that it was quite impossible for me to keep such a book in my possession, and begging him, if he wished to continue on good terms with me, and not once more to break up our newly re-established entente, not to mention it or discuss it with me. Beyond a jocular remark about my prudery, he never referred to the subject again. From what I saw of Harris's book, I think that if all the filth were cut out of it, it would make a very interesting biography. Harris's life, apart from his sordid and depressing amateur adventures, was, according to his own account, dramatic and adventurous. His father, if I remember right, was a skipper in the merchant service. Harris ran away from home at the age of about 16 and went to America, where he was in turn a bellboy, a cowboy, an advertising canvasser, and a journalist. He seems to have had a thirst for knowledge and a real love of literature, and some rich man paid for him to go to a university. I believe he is a good scholar. You cannot be in his company more than an hour without hearing him quote a long passage in Greek from the Odyssey. He does it with great gusto and in a sonorous voice. It is true that it is always the same passage, but on the strength of it, I am quite prepared to accept his word that he is, or was, a good Greek scholar. I myself knew Greek quite well when I was at Oxford. The other day I came across 2 volumes of Herodotus which I used when I was reading for Greats. They were interleaved and had copious notes in my handwriting, including long passages in Greek. I am, I regret to say, utterly unable to read or understand a word of Greek today, so I should be the last to deny Harris's title to have been the scholar he claims to have been. I know that he was for a time a master at Brighton Grammar School, but what he taught the boys there I have no idea. His chief asset at the time when I first met him in London was, as it is today, his deep and impressive voice, his sucking dove roar, as Crossland in Shakespearean phrase called it. He and Wilde met at a dinner party, and Harris told the company an epic story about some prize fight, where Slavin, the Australian fighter, was attacked by the crowd, and how he fought the whole lot with his back to the wall. Oscar, who up till then had disliked and avoided Harris, was fascinated by the splendid way Harris told the story. He complimented Harris, and they immediately became friends. Harris was afterwards owner and editor of the Saturday Review, and later of Vanity Fair. When he had the last named paper, I occasionally wrote for him, and he published in its columns a quantity of my light verse, as well as one or two of my sonnets. Harris has written a lot about Shakespeare. His book, Shakespeare the Man, is interesting, and shows that he has a profound knowledge of Shakespeare's text, but the conclusions he arrives at seem to me to be fantastic and demonstrably false. As I pointed out in an article in Plain English, Harris's main idea was to prove that Shakespeare was very much the same sort of man as Harris. This is not a view that I can accept. Quite apart from anything he has written about me in his book, The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, it is very easy to demonstrate that Frank Harris is a monumental liar, and worthy in that respect to rank with Robert Ross and Wilde himself. When I was his guest at Nice in 1925, he was rash enough to present me with a copy of his book, Contemporary Portraits, Fourth Series. The first pen portraits in the book are those of Wilfred Scawen Blunt and George Wyndham, both of whom were my cousins, and with both of whom I was on very intimate terms. I quote the first paragraph of the chapter more as an example of ignorance than lying. The other day Wilfred Blunt died, when over 80 years old, and left everything he possessed to his secretary. Those who knew the man and the chief circumstances were not surprised, but most people, and particularly those who knew a little, were dumbfounded. Surely Blunt had a daughter. Why had he not left his property, and especially Crabbett Park, to her? Anyone who knows anything at all about the matter knows that Mr. Blunt's daughter, my cousin Judith, formerly the Honourable Mrs. Neville Lytton, and now Lady Wentworth, she is a peeress in her own right, is in possession of Crabbett Park, which her father made over to her in his lifetime. When he died, he left the little Jacobean manor house, New Buildings Place, and a few hundred acres to his cousin, Miss Dorothy Carlton, who had kept house for him during the last few years of his life. This house was not a family place, and he was, of course, free to leave it away from his daughter, who, in addition to the entailed property, had all her mother Lady Anne's money, and will also ultimately inherit a large part of Lord Lovelace's property. Harris goes on to talk of "When I knew Blunt in the 80s, and, following his usual custom in dealing with dead celebrities, he pretends to an intimacy which is purely imaginary, and reports long and equally imaginary conversations." Wilfred Blunt told me that he had seen Harris only once, when he came to interview him for a paper, and that after a conversation lasting about 5 minutes, he rang the bell and told the servant to show Harris out. Harris, in the same chapter of his book, gives a long account of the meeting of the Crabbett Club when Oscar Wilde was attacked, in a chafing way, in an after-dinner speech, by the late Lord Curzon of Kedleston, and Oscar's reply. He represents that he, Harris, was present on this occasion. He goes on to give an account of what happened the year after that, at the annual meeting of the Crabbett Club, when, as it happens, I, the youngest and most recently elected member, was present. Again, he describes the scene throughout as if he had been present, and he says plainly that he was a member of the club. This is an almost incredible piece of impudence. Harris never belonged to the Crabbett Club, and was never present at any meeting of that club. There are at least a dozen members of the club now living who could bear me out in this. For instance, Lord Crewe and Mr. Lawrence Currie. Harris describes the whole scene from the description which I gave to him and Wilde at the time. He goes on to give conversations with George Wyndham which bear the plainest evidence of their utter falsity on their surface. Wyndham, it is true, did know Harris slightly, and, I believe, once dined with him and his wife in Park Lane, but he disliked and mistrusted Harris intensely, and when I became very friendly with Harris at the time of the South African War, when George was Under Secretary for War, he wrote me a letter warning me against having anything to do with Harris, of whom he expressed a very low opinion. The rest of Harris's book consists of portraits of persons with most of whom I have never had any personal acquaintance. But ex pede Herculem. As to Robert Ross, when I first met him he was a rather pathetic-looking little creature, in appearance something like a kitten. He was the son of a Canadian lawyer, who, I believe, at one time occupied a prominent position in Canadian politics, but who was ruined financially by the Grand Trunk Railway smash. Robert Ross, called by his friends Bobby or Robbie, lived with his mother, Mrs. Ross, a charming old lady who had a house in Onslow Gardens. He went up to Cambridge, but after he had been a year there he was ragged by the undergraduates of his college, King's, and ducked in the fountain. The reason of his unpopularity I do not know, but anyhow he left Cambridge abruptly. At the time I first met him, about 18 months later, he had known Oscar Wilde for about a year. He had by that time moved into rooms of his own in Church Street, Kensington, number 39, I think. He had a tiny bedroom and sitting room there, and an allowance from his mother of £200 a year. He earned a little more by writing for the Saturday Review, under the editorship of the late Mr. Pollock. He also knew Henley, and introduced me to him in Henley's favourite resort, the Solferino Café, now extinct, in Rupert Street. Henley liked Ross in those days, and, I believe, also gave him work. Afterwards, Henley's hatred of Oscar Wilde caused a breach between them. The same cause prevented Henley from printing in his monthly review, The New Review, my Ballad of Perkin Warbeck, which he greatly admired, and which was shown to him on my behalf by George Street, at that time a great friend of mine. Ross was, by way of being devoted to me in those days, if I had followed his example and kept the letters he wrote to me, I could have showed that he professed devotion and admiration for me in as extravagant terms as those used by Wilde. It was I that made Ross socially, for, but for me, he would never have got to know the people in society whose countenance he so skilfully exploited in later years. I brought him to my mother's house in Cadogan Place, where he met a lot of people whom, without any desire to be snobbish, I can only describe as being in a much higher class than himself. I also, later, introduced him to the Glen Connors, through which he became very friendly with Mrs. Asquith, who was his principal standby after his debacle in 1914, and who also signed the celebrated testimonial which was given to him after his exposure at the Old Bailey. In the early days I was very fond of Ross, and it is difficult for me to realise, even now, that he was the same man who afterwards treated me in so cruel and abominable a fashion. I cannot recall another instance of such a complete change of character as that which took place in this nervous, affectionate, sentimental and emotional little man, between the time when I first met him and the last 12 years of his life. The last time I set eyes on him in 1914 at the Old Bailey, he was, I must say, not a pleasant object to behold. It would have been impossible to recognise the slender, attractive, impulsive boy I had once known in that sinister-looking, bloated and bald-headed person, with his snaky eyes, his round, bulging face and body, and his nigger-like mouth and teeth. Ross left about £40,000 when he died. How he got it I do not know, though I can make a guess. When I first knew him he had only a small allowance from his mother, and was always desperately hard up. At her death he got a small income, certainly not more than £500 a year. He then ran a little picture shop in Ryder Street, and it afterwards blossomed into a bigger establishment known as Carfax in Berry Street. According to what he told me himself, this business was never a great financial success. But he became friendly with the Asquiths, and the late Lord Oxford, when he was Prime Minister, gave him a government appointment as Assessor of Picture Valuations to the Board of Trade. After the collapse of his prosecution of me at the Old Bailey, to which I have already alluded, he, of course, lost this job. He was given another job later, during the premiership of Mr. Lloyd George, but he died suddenly one night just after he had got his appointment and before he had had time to enjoy any of its fruits. His great friend, when I knew him, was Mr. Moready, also at one time a great friend of my own, and after Ross left Church Street, Kensington, he and Ady shared rooms for years in Haunton Street, and afterwards again in another house in Church Street. Ross died in rooms in Half Moon Street, which he had occupied then for several years. I am informed that his death took place on the night after he had given a dinner at Prince's Restaurant to a company of his friends to celebrate his new appointment. He was found dead in the morning by his servant. He was undoubtedly a man of brains and ability, and a good talker. After Wilde's death, he seemed to make a fairly successful effort to model himself on Wilde as a conversationalist. His writings consisted of only a few odd papers. I myself published a story by him in my Oxford magazine, The Spirit Lamp. It was called How We Lost the Book of Jasher. It was quite a good story, but Ross never had any real pretensions to outstanding literary talent, and would never have come into prominence apart from his association with Wilde, and the fact that he had become Wilde's literary executor. He played this up for all he was worth, and he made numerous friends in more or less prominent positions in society. His method was flattery, laid on with a trowel. He could, when he liked, make himself very agreeable, and he always contrived to convey to the particular person with whom he wished to ingratiate himself that he or she was the object of his profound and respectful admiration. When you had had 10 minutes' conversation with him, you went away with a pleasing feeling that you were really an important person, and that Ross appreciated it and would never be likely to forget it. The resultant glow of satisfaction, multiplied in hundreds of different cases, produced the atmosphere which enabled Ross to climb into a position which was far beyond the wildest dreams of his youth. Max Beerbohm was my contemporary at Oxford, and we were on intimate terms. I met him through his chief friend there, Reggie Turner, also a contemporary and a great friend of mine. They were both friends of Ross's and Ady's. I published in my undergraduate paper, The Spirit Lamp, the first article of Max's that ever appeared in print. It was an essay on the incomparable beauty of modern dress. It was an entirely characteristic piece of cleverness and artificiality, and caused intense annoyance to the Philistines of the period. I do not think it has ever been reprinted. It was signed J. M. Beerbohm. When I quarrelled with Ross, I lost touch with both Turner and Beerbohm. This I regretted very much, especially in the case of Turner, of whom I was very fond, and who was at one time quite devoted to me. When I was in Cairo, as the guest of the Cromers, Reggie Turner was staying with his half-brother, Frank Lawson, on a dahabiyah, which was the last word in comfort and luxury. I was a frequent guest on the boat. Reggie Turner is the author of a number of novels, but I believe the only poem he ever wrote in his life was addressed to me. It was a sonnet, and was produced after terrific wrestlings of the spirit on board the dahabiyah. I remember only the first two lines. More fair than any flower is thy face, thy limbs from all comparison are free. Reggie Turner, Robert Hitchens, and E.F. Benson were all at Luxor, staying in the same hotel as myself, and we went up the Nile in a post-boat. I saw a lot of Hitchens at Luxor, and he wrote his book The Green Carnation entirely on the strength and as the result of his association with me, for he had at that time never met Oscar Wilde. The book did me a lot of harm, and the writing of it, and the appropriation without acknowledgement of a large number of my good things and jokes, constituted a piece of perfidy for which I refrain from reproaching its author, because he has publicly expressed his contrition for it. Freddie Benson, on the other hand, was a real friend, who tried to influence me in the right direction, and who also endeavoured to get his publisher, Methuen, to publish my poems. Methuen declined them after being kind enough to say that they showed a certain amount of promise, and they were afterwards turned down by, among others, Heinemann. As already related, they were first published in 1896 by the Mercure de France, and in London in 1899 by Grant Richards. I afterwards, when I became a Catholic, was a great friend of Hugh Benson, Monsignor Benson, and stayed with him on several occasions in his house near Buntingford. I knew Aubrey Beardsley, and met him often in London with Wilde and Ross, but truth compels me to say that I did not like him, although I greatly admired some of his drawings. I liked poor Dowson, and regret that in the last 2 years of his life, when he was living on a small pittance from Smithers, the publisher, I did not do what I might have done to help him. I also used to meet Arthur Symons pretty frequently, but I was never on anything like terms of friendship or intimacy with him. I recognise his great talents now more than I did in those days, but from the poetical point of view, he belongs to a school which I cannot truthfully profess to admire. End of chapter 11.